a crack, the whistle of a round, a wet thud behind him. He exhaled, letting the pine cone drop. The sniper to the south was a weaker shot, a fact that Evan filed away for future use. It was a trial of one, sure, but that was all he was willing to risk. Judging by the miss, he was lucky his hand was still connected to his wrist. His cheeks and nose felt stiff, his flesh gone to rubber. Time to get indoors. Turning back, he eyed where the bullet had blown a hole through the side of a soggy log, revealing clumps of moss and a white conical cap the size of a quail egg. Drawing close, he knelt with his back to the sniper and pretended to tie his bootlaces. He studied the mushroom. It grew singly out of a sack at the base of the stem. A thin skein of moss covered the cap. Evan plucked it and ran a nail across the surface, revealing pure white beneath. Amanita verrosa. Destroying angel. Even a few drops of its juice could shut down a person's kidneys. He rose, palming the mushroom to hide it from the sniper. As he started down the mountainside, he pinched at the cap with a thumbnail, chopping it into tiny pieces, which he wadded in his hand. Breaking from cover, he looked up at the tower guard peering down at him through the graying air. Holding the powdered bits in a loose fist, he walked over toward the barn and the deserted fire. The tower was behind him now, but he could hear the skinny guard chattering into the radio. Evan neared the barn door, the crates where the narcos sat, the pot hanging over the fire. He'd barely arrived when the door rolled open, both Dobermans charging at him. Snapping and snarling, they strained their leashes into straight lines. Two narcos spilled out after them, AK-47s raised, barking orders in Spanish. Evan pointed to the fire, made a shivering gesture. The guards yelled some more, one of them prodding him toward the house with a gun barrel. He gave no resistance, stumbling from being shoved. Shuddering in his layers of clothes, he hastened his pace toward the porch, dusting off his empty hands. 24. A complex, sticky business. Crimea smelled like sewage, artillery shells, and boiled hot dogs. Candy strolled with Ben Jaggers along a boardwalk overlooking a rocky beach. Holding his arm through his raincoat felt like clutching a stick wrapped in cloth. A head taller than him, she wore leather pants and a bustier top. She'd teased out her blonde hair voluminously, hoping to pass for a local girl. Jaggers was playing the role of a rich married guy out for a little fun, though he seemed to have forgotten to tell his face. He slouched along in a plaid button-up and brown slacks. She felt like a Bentley being taken for a spin by the mechanic's kid. Girls passed by, laughing and waving lipstick-smeared cigarettes. They were magnificent creatures, as girls from this region of the world were, all fuck-you sneers and aggressive makeup. Tights wrapped their impossibly long legs, and they wore white platform boots capped with fur, trotting along with the graceful force of Clydesdales. As they wafted by in clouds of hairspray, smoke, and knockoff Chanel No. 5, the sullen little man at Candy's side didn't so much as raise his head to take in the girl power scenery. His nose twitched, his mouth pursing as if on the verge of hawking a loogie. He smelled vaguely of mothballs. A camera dangled from around his neck, bouncing off what passed for his chest. He eyed the streets behind the boardwalk, his hand tightening on her forearm. "Here," he said. She posed for him, leaning back against the railing as he snapped photos. Though he pretended to focus on her, he was really zooming in over her shoulder on a building up the hill from the beach. She blew kisses. Scoop crossed her arms to shove her tits together, turned sideways and threw up a Marilyn Monroe leg. He continued shooting the boulevard behind her. Most of them have cleared out, but he's still in the office on the second floor, he said, his words snatched away by the wind. They'd spent the day photographing the building from every angle. The mottled skin of Candy's back complained beneath her fitted top, no doubt angry from the cold breeze and salty air. She put the pain in the bank, a mental account she'd been saving up for Orphan X. She couldn't wait to start taking withdrawals out of his flesh. Willing away the discomfort, she smacked her bubblegum. The gum was neon green, her lipstick orange, both props to help her blend in. A gaggle of girls legged by, giving her competitive glares. God bless these Ukrainian-Russian broads. They oozed so much natural sexuality that they could slap the 1980s all over themselves and still knock the skin right off an American girl. Except for Candy, of course. She leaned over, grabbing her knees, gave the knock-'em-dead smile. Jaggers clicked and clicked. "Everyone else is gone," he said. "He's the last one there now." "Hey, Em," she said. "It's not polite to not stare at a lady, especially when she looks like this." She straightened up, spreading her stance, arms on her hips, her breasts pushing high. Colossus of Rhodes if he was fucking hot. Jaggers moved the camera to the side of his cheek. His flat eyes observed her, blinked. The zoom lens drifted over her shoulder. More clicking. At least it blocked his face. She should be thankful for small mercies. She thought about the kind of fun she could have here, if it weren't for Orphan M. Of course the mission was primary. Though they'd been in country for only 12 hours, they'd ascertained a few things. The phone service company to which Orphan X had moved his number was located on the second and third floors of the converted cannery that Jaggers was currently lensed in on. Given present conditions in Crimea and the Nowhere Man's proclivities, it was no surprise that Telephone Star placed a premium on the privacy of their customers. Van Sciver had identified the target as Refat Setyayeva, vice president of operations, a thick-bodied man with scruffy good looks. A youthful 40, he had come up as a hammer thrower in the Soviet Olympic program, juiced and primed from the age of 8. He'd blown out his knees in his late teens, and here he was, overseeing operations for the discreet comms company that Candy and Jaggers needed to infiltrate. Rather than dick around with hacking through firewalls, which neither of them specialized in, they'd been tasked with stealing Sityayeva's laptop to get the passwords and access the company databases. They were to eliminate him to buy themselves time with the computer before it could be reported as missing. Given Setyayeva's sturdiness and physical prowess, this would be challenging. Attaining a gun in this climate would be conspicuous. So they'd come up with another plan. Jaggers let the camera drop from around his neck. "He's leaving now." He checked his watch, jotted down the time in his notepad with a skinny silver pen. Candy pictured the route Refat Setyayeva would likely trace on his way out, through the rear door and across the narrow alley to the parking structure next door. There were specifics to lockdown, angles to consider, sight lines to account for. It would be a complex, sticky business, and success rested on timing and preparation. As her junior high shop teacher used to say, "Measure twice, cut once." 25. Not very nice. Back in his luxurious cell, Evan checked his phone to see if the boy had called back, but the shattered screen showed no missed calls. He slid the room zone between mattress and box spring again and went into the bathroom. Getting down on his hands and knees by the sink in the hidden camera's blind spot, he stared at the J-plug outlet placed beneath the floating counter. Then he rolled onto his back and smashed the plastic cover with the heel of his boot. It took only a few kicks for it to chip and fall away. Beneath it was nothing but an empty hole in the drywall. Wires stubbed out of the socket, connected to nothing. It was a prop, inserted in the space where a functional outlet had been. He broke the cover into smaller pieces and flushed them down the toilet. In the bedroom again, he crawled beneath the built-in desk. The Type-C outlet was there in the darkness behind the back panel and the wall. He slipped his hand into the gap and managed to slide the edge of his thumbnail into the groove of one of the tiny screws. After 5 minutes of cramped machinations, the screw pinged loose, the outlet cover swinging down to reveal the blank wall beneath. Evan sat back on his heels and marveled at Renee's attention to detail. So many fakes and misdirects. Impeccable tradecraft. When he crawled out, Despy was once more standing by the fireplace. She wore lipstick and a hair tie.
"Wanna not have sex again?"
Her full lips shaped the words, a hoarse whisper to thwart the surveillance. He drew himself upright.
"Don't you get cold?"
She stepped closer, her hips tick-tocking. She ran a finger along his jaw.
"What I feel is irrelevant. There's only what I have to do."
Her flat words and expression were divorced from her body language, which she laid on thick for the hidden camera. He regretted the joke. She undressed him, pulling off the layers. Then she slid her hand to the nape of his neck, tugging him toward her.
"Should we get this over with?"
The sensuous affect, paired with her matter-of-fact declarations, made her seem like an actress who'd been given the wrong dialogue. Evan steered her to the same spot on the bed, keeping them mostly in the camera's blind spot. She pulled him on top of her, putting her mouth to his ear.
"You have very strong willpower."
"To not rape you?"
"What it would be," she said, "is complicated."
"Not to me."
"So virtuous."
Her lips tugged to one side, a smirk.
"Have you decided that you trust me?"
"Mostly."
"Only mostly?"
She feigned offense.
"Well, I have no chopstick. So, how would you kill me now, virtuous man? Right now?"
He ran his fingers through her thick hair.
"I'd rake your head to the side hard enough to fragment your C2 vertebra into your brainstem."
She took a moment with that one.
"And there is a Hollywood movie, Krakow, and then I'd die instantly?"
"No. You'd be a quadriplegic. Maybe you could still speak.
Or scream.
But the break would cut off impulses from your brain to your diaphragm, and you'd eventually suffocate." Their faces were close, and they spoke in whispers.
"That's not very nice," she said.
"No."
"I'm glad you mostly trust me."
She clasped her hands around his ribs and pulled him tighter. She was skilled at selling the performance. He cringed to think of the experiences that had led her to perfect this skill set.
"How did you get here?"
he asked. "Were you taken like me?"
"I was stupid. There was a party on a yacht docked off the coast of Rhodes. That's where I'm from. My girlfriend was going, and she asked me to join. I was recently divorced, so I said what the hell. Rene was there. I interested him. Not sexually, but as an object. He takes things and people. He doesn't understand the difference."
"No," Evan said. "He doesn't seem to."
"He thinks I am a Greek goddess. It is the only thing we agree on."
"How did he take you?"
"I drank the champagne. I woke up very much later out at sea. He showed me pictures of my parents in our little apartment. My younger sister at the Athens School of Fine Arts. She's 19. Renee had her class schedule printed up. He set the pictures and documents before me, but said nothing. He didn't have to.
He studied her liquid brown eyes for a sign that she was lying. How long ago was that?
17 months, 2 weeks, and a day.
I'm sorry.
Me too.
You weren't stupid.
Yes, I was.
That doesn't mean it was my fault, though. A pause. When people think of human trafficking, they think of Thai virgins kidnapped from villages and shipped overseas. But sometimes, it's just drinking the wrong glass of champagne.
She let that one land for a moment, then said, "But I don't know how to fragment a C2 vertebra into someone's brainstem. So, I must do this."
Her grip on his back flagged.
"You're no good at not having sex."
"Thanks." She flipped them over so she was on top.
"Let me be in charge."
"Gladly." Her hips did something magical.
"Is that you getting aroused?" she asked.
"No," he said. "Uh-uh," he said. "Nope," he said. She smiled.
"Maybe I should be less in charge?"
"Maybe so." She eased off him a bit. All of a sudden, outside lights went on, flooding the bedroom through the sliding glass door. There were shouts and sounds of commotion. Evan got up, pulled on his jeans, and stumbled through the slider, the balcony frosted beneath his bare soles. By the barn, 4 narcos were laid out on their backs, making tiny, listless movements. Another was curled on the wet ground beside them, clutching his stomach, vomit drooling from the side of his mouth. The skinny guard was off the tower, radioing frantically. He waved around one of the slender white remotes, clicking on more lights to illuminate the grounds. Samuel staggered out of the barn, veering unevenly toward the fire. He banged into the suspended pot, knocking it to the ground. A sludge of chili spilled out. Samuel sat heavily on a crate, wiping sweat from his brow. He pointed to the dark glop of chili on the ground. The skinny guard's posture changed. His rail-thin shoulders lowered. He crouched and picked up one of the bone china plates resting on a crate. Let it drop from his hand. It shattered. He sat on the crate, lowered his head into his hand. Then he rose, doubled over, and ran into the barn, no doubt looking for a toilet.
"What?" Despy said, keeping a few steps back from the threshold to the balcony. "What is it?"
Before Evan could answer, he heard the resonant boom of the chalet's front door opening. A moment later, Dex lumbered off the porch into view, his massive back bowed, his shadow elongated before him. He approached the barn and spoke to Samuel.
Hard rain spit at Evan. He squinted through the haze as Samuel slid off the crate, collapsing to the ground. 2 dogs, 3 guards, 2 snipers, and Dex.
Dex turned, the lights of the eaves hitting him full in the face, his pale bald head seeming to glow. He stared directly out the balcony, at Evan. For a chilling moment, they locked eyes through the quickening rain. Dex lifted his left hand and slapped the bloody scowl across his face. The tattoo colors were sharp in the glare, glossy red dripping from pointy incisors. Evan backed into the room.
"What is it?" Despy asked.
The door flew open. Manny charged in, shotgun raised, firing a beanbag round that hit Evan's center mass. It knocked him into the wall. He slid down lurchingly to sit on the floor. Nando grabbed Despy's bare shoulder and flung her behind him. She banged into the desk before falling to the floorboards at Renee's feet. With a polished loafer, Renee shooed her toward the door. She staggered a bit, pulling herself upright in time to collide with Dex's chest, now filling the doorway. His rain-wet shirt clung to him, every muscle pronounced. He grabbed her by the wrist, wrenching her arm and tugged her out of view. A moment later, a door opened and slammed up the hall, and Dex returned, pocketing a key. Evan's lungs were locked up. He couldn't breathe. With the toe of his boot, Manny tipped him over, cuffed his hands, hoisted him onto the bed. Evan leaned forward, his mouth wavering, air still out of reach. At last, his muscles relaxed, and he drew in a screeching breath, and then another. Renee walked over and leaned casually against the desk, examining his fingernails. "Let's have a talk," he said. 26. Man or Nature? Evan sat on the bed, his wrists cuffed painfully behind him. The flexible baton round had left a red mark the size of a fist in the middle of his chest. He was still having trouble finding oxygen. And yet, Renee wanted to talk. "My guard seemed to have been stricken with an illness. Vomiting, diarrhea, crippling abdominal pain. I don't suppose you know anything about that."
"I don't."
Renee nodded, as if Evan had confessed. "Your skills are fascinating," he said. "I want to know more about you." Evan managed to get out a few words.
"Not that interesting."
"You are to me." Renee removed a kerchief, wiped his brow. His face was flushed from all the excitement. "What are you?"
"A drug kingpin. An arms dealer."
"No. You're more lethal than that. Something doesn't add up about you. I've been thinking about your hobby, killing Contrell. Who does something like that? Who kills a human trafficker for fun?" Evan did not respond. "I'd imagine the same kind of person who would poison my guards," Renee said. "Dr. Franklin is seeing to the men now." Manny and Nando glared at Evan, looking as though they'd like to beat him to death with their shotguns. Manny took a menacing step toward him, but Renee held up a hand, and he halted.
"Those are our hermanos," Manny snarled.
"No," Renee said. "They were my employees, and they failed at their job. Make sure you don't fail at yours." Dex barely had to move for the floorboards to groan beneath him. Manny looked at him, then stepped back into line. Renee returned his attention to Evan. "There are two kinds of people in the world, those who make messes and those who clean them up." The handcuffs forced Evan to hunch forward, but he looked up at Renee through a tangle of hair.
"Which kind are you?"
"The third kind. Who gets to make the categories?" His eyes gleamed from their burrows in his face. "You made a big mess tonight." Evan stared at Manny.
"Or cleaned one up."
Manny slid his tongue across his gold grill as if Evan were something he'd like to eat. Someone tapped on the door, and then a man with long white hair came in, wearing a pair of tattered scrubs. The doctor hadn't shaved in a few days. He had the wrecked good looks of an aging surfer who'd lived through one too many tequila sunrises. "Hi." Dr. Franklin looked across at Evan. "Oh, hey." Then at Renee.
"Talk to you."
Renee stepped out into the hall. Hushed murmurs carried back inside, though the words were unintelligible. Nando and Manny glowered at Evan. It was an uncomfortable few minutes. Finally, Renee returned. "Six of my guards are in bad shape. Internal bleeding, renal failure. Their kidneys seem to be shut down." Manny made a noise between a growl and a cry. "It is Dr. Franklin's opinion that they ingested poisonous mushrooms."
"It's hard to distinguish them sometimes," Evan said sympathetically.
"None of them claim to have picked any mushrooms, let alone added them to their chili. If I added mushrooms to chili, I wouldn't admit it either, Evan said. He watched Manny's jaw tighten and enjoyed it a bit. Renee cleared his throat. Evan was surprised to see his brown eyes moisten. There's nothing anyone can do, Renee said. He added quickly, and no major medical facilities nearby. Here in Graubünden, Evan added. The chocolate eyes sharpened. That's right. Renee swept a hand over his hair, though no strands were out of place. They'll die within days. In excruciating pain. Evan directed a look at Manny and Nando. You should put them out of their misery. It's the only humane thing to do. Manny and Nando studied the floorboards, waiting on their orders. Evan switched his gaze to Renee. Dying men drain resources quickly, he added. You should consider what's best for everyone. After a moment, Renee gave a little nod. Do it kindly, he said. Manny bared his 14-carat teeth at Evan on his way out, and then Evan was alone with Renee and Dex. You're upset, Evan said. Not for them. For me. Why's that? We all get sad when someone dies. It reminds one of one's mortality. Jack's blood-drenched hand trying to stem the arterial spray from his shoulder. The crimson-soaked blue flannel mopped around Evan's fist. Jack's smile, rare as a rainbow, warming his eyes at the corners. Evan said, That's why you think people get sad. Remember when you first found out about death as a child? I never got over it. I don't think any of us do. It's an awful thing, to die. I don't buy any of the marketing pitches that try to assuage the horror of it. Heroics of war, drifting off into a blaze of white, the welcoming arms of God. Renee's teeth clenched, a sudden intensity. I don't want to, he said, and I won't. You'd be the first. His lips pursed, pulled taut. Remember how long summer used to last when you were a child? An eternity. Everything still in front of you. Life feels limitless. He folded his hands at his waist and studied them. And then one day, you see a picture. You're in your 30s, getting out of a pool in Santorini. And your hair is thinning, so much so that you can see the scalp beneath. It's been that way for a year. Maybe years. How often do you see a photograph of yourself swimming? His palm rose again, hovering over his thinning hair. He seemed to realize what he was doing and pulled his hand away. I don't like limits, being told what is possible, by man or nature. Just like you. No, Evan said. You want to be everything. I want to be one thing well. Then you suffer from a failure of imagination. Renee leaned forward, a fall of light illuminating his meaty features, the dried dabs of cover-up, the augmented hairline. We all want to beat death. It just becomes embarrassing to admit. But think, if you could, control time. If you control time, you control everything. When he leaned back against the chairless desk, the thick fabric of his suit rippled like spread butter. Imagine being who you were in your 20s. Like the good book says, you can't repeat the past. Renee smiled, showing a gleaming row of beautiful ivory caps. Why, of course you can. The cuffs were cutting off the circulation in Evan's hands. He wondered how long Renee was going to leave them on. Renee produced the skinny bottle and sprayed down the surfaces he'd touched. Uncuff him and lock him in, he told Dex. On his way out, He paused before the big man. No need to be gentle. Dex's softball biceps flexed as he raised his right hand and cupped it over his mouth. Happy face. 27. 6 in total. Evan lay on his back in the darkness, waiting for the gas to hiss through the vent and knock him out. He was tired enough to sleep without the encouragement, but there was no way Renee could know that. He had just drifted off when a distant gunshot woke him, and then another. They kept on at regular intervals, one after another. 6 in total. The vibration of the final bullet held the air for an extra few moments, unwilling to let go. At last, there was complete silence. Evan stared at the ceiling. To Allison, to the boy, he sent a simple thought. I'm coming soon. Then he fell asleep on his own. 28. The Grim Reaperess. The next morning, Evan was roused from sleep with a shotgun pressed into the side of his neck. He opened his eyes, looking up the length of the barrel past the neon orange stalk, at Manny. Manny grimaced, those teeth flashing. Jaws from James Bond, gone rapper. Get your culo up. Evan eased to a sitting position. The metal bore remained shoved into the side of his throat. Nando stood 5 feet away and to the side, a second shotgun at the ready. You're wanted downstairs, Manny told him. But I'm thinking, maybe you have a accidente right here. You made a move on me. I reacted. Evan's eyes slid to Manny's finger on the trigger. His knuckle was white. The trigger partially depressed. Another 1/2 pound of pressure, and the opposite wall would be wearing Evan's trachea. Samuel. Johannes. Alcides. Memo. Luis. Eddie. I will not forget those names. Manny's voice shook. We took them out to the woods last night. And said goodbye. Tears leaked from his eyes. But he kept the shotgun level, making no move to wipe his face. He glided the barrel up Evan's chin, ground it across his cheek, shoved his nose to the side. Evan didn't meet his eyes. He looked at the far wall, kept his body language neutral, hoped he hadn't pushed Manny far enough that he'd contradict Renee's orders and kill the golden goose. Though Evan had stared down more gun barrels than he'd care to recount, decapitation by beanbag presented new intricacies he didn't want to contemplate. Santa Muerte's skull head grinned from the side of Manny's neck. The Grim Reaperess. She wore a blue cloak bedecked with roses, one skeletal hand clutching a scythe, the other an hourglass. At the moment of death, she was said to sever the silver thread of life. Evan wondered if now was the moment that the scythe would fall, that his own thread would be cut. He stared ahead, waited for a 1 centimeter movement of Manny's knuckle. Manny, Nando said. Manny! He stepped forward and tugged at Manny's shoulder. An instant later, the pressure relented. We won't forget what you made us do, Manny said. Now get your shit downstairs. Evan was marched along the ground floor through a moist corridor scented of lavender and rose water. At Nando and Manny's prompting, he pushed through a glass door beaded with condensation and stepped into a sprawling spa area. They passed a jacuzzi, a cold water plunge pool, a tea bag stuffed with herbs slung into a freestanding marble tub. Various enclosures were labeled with sleek metal placards. Sauna, eucalyptus steam room, rain shower. The Korean mist room featured a concrete bench studded with large smooth pebbles, matching the Zen Disneyland motif of the rest of the spa. They came to a small lap pool fringed with artificial grass that crunched pleasingly beneath Evan's bare feet. He was wearing only the boxer shorts he'd slept in. Renee waited, cocked back in a zero-gravity chair, paperback hoisted overhead, the inverted V like a bird in flight. An IV tube snaked from one arm to a saline bag dangling off a chrome stand. Smoking an electronic cigarette, David propped himself against a paisley-shaped bar made of rich, polished wood and decorated with a string of fat Christmas lights. A bottle of Bacardi 151 sat beside his rocks glass, which was filled to the brim with square ice cubes and the amber rum. A tray of bar treats waited at his elbow. He munched Doritos from a crinkly bag, puffed vapor, sipped his drink. Renee rotated forward in his chair, sinking his feet into a bubbling tank suffused with blue UV lighting. As Evan neared, he noticed dozens of tiny fish inside, swirling about Renee's feet and ankles.
Renee flicked his paper back toward the bar.
"Made from sustainably farmed rainforest wood from Brazil," he said. "Can you imagine caring that much?" "Why do you have it, then?" "None of this is mine." His gesture encompassed the chalet. "I rent this life. What is mine is hidden away down a rabbit hole. A smile. Just like you do it." Leaning over a side table, he exchanged his book for one of the slender white remotes that seemed to operate the entire chalet and its personnel. He keyed a few buttons and let it rattle back onto the table. A moment later, two huge metal panels in the far wall parted to reveal a narrow elevator with Dr. Franklin inside. He trudged over to Renee, cautiously removed the IV from the crook of his elbow, and scurried back to the elevator. The doors closed, and Evan watched the lit numbers above as the doctor descended to a basement level. Straightening his pricked arm, Renee buttoned his shirt sleeve. Even here in the humidity of the spa, his sartorial elegance was on display. "Would you like a refreshment?" "Bag of Doritos would be good." "Nando, please fetch our guest some chips." Before Nando could move, David reached for a bag. "Don't, David," Renee said. "Let Nando handle it." David smiled around his plastic e-smoke filter, the blinking Christmas lights casting his face in different colors. He pushed himself off the bar, walked across to Evan, and held out the bag. Manny and Nando moved closer, aiming at Evan's head. David shook the bag in front of Evan. "Go on," he said. Evan took the Doritos. David scanned Evan's body. "You don't strike me as the junk food type."
"You don't strike me as the e-cigarette type."
"Oh, this. I'm trying to work my way up to real cigarettes, but I hate the taste. I just graduated from nicotine patches."
"Congratulations."
David gave a mock curtsy.
"Step away from him," Renee said.
"He's not gonna hurt me," David said.
Renee tilted his head at Manny, who gently but firmly pulled David back toward the bar while Nando and his raised shotgun eased into Evan's blind spot. David returned to his overproof rum.
"You're such a dick," he said into his rocks glass. "You think you can control everything."
He gulped down the rest, slammed the heavy tumbler on the sustainably farmed rainforest wood, and ambled out. Renee smiled indulgently. He followed Evan's gaze, looking down at his feet. In the tank, the fish had clustered around his toes and heels.
"You starve them, you see. Doctor Fish. At a certain point of hunger, they develop a taste for human flesh.
I suppose anything will.
They eat away the dead skin, slough off the calluses and psoriasis patches."
The grin widened.
"Nibble away my imperfections."
He waved a hand.
"You're welcome to have a treatment yourself."
Evan pictured himself with cucumber slices on his eyes, slathered with mud. Manny and Nando zeroed in on him over shotgun sights.
"No thanks."
"Maybe have Dr. Franklin do some laser treatment on that nasty scar on your stomach."
Evan stared down at the white line on his abdomen, where a woman had once slid his own knife beneath his ribs. He'd stitched it up himself on the floor of his bathroom, a bloody, painful affair during which he'd discovered fresh nuances in an already intimate relationship with pain.
"I like my scars," he said. "They remind me of who I am."
"I don't understand that."
"You don't need to," Evan said. "Why am I here? I assume not just to discuss your grooming habits. Do you have somewhere you need to be?"
Evan thought of the Horizon Express steaming onward, and the boy's voice coming through the wrecked rum zone. "Will you help me? Will you? Promise me."
"Yes," he said.
Renee said, "2 more days, and you can be on your way.
Assuming I send the wire."
"You haven't resigned yourself to the outcome.
Why give up when I'm winning the war?"
Behind him, Evan heard Manny curse at him in Spanish. "About that,"
Renee lifted one dripping foot from the tank and then the other.
"There's something I'd like to show you."
Pulling on a heavy robe, he knotted the sash. Then he leaned over and sprayed down the zero-gravity chair with mist from a clear cylindrical bottle.
"What is that?" Evan asked.
"Privacy spray. It removes 99.5% of DNA from surfaces, and obscures the remaining 0.5% by layering it over with a blend of genetic material." Renee stomped his feet into a waiting pair of moon boots.
"You're not the only one who can make himself disappear. When I decide I don't want to be found, no one ever finds me."
For now, Evan let that go. Manny and Nando got Evan moving back through the gauntlet of steam rooms and up various hallways, Renee keeping well ahead of them. At last, the giant chandelier of the foyer bloomed overhead. Tightening his thick bathrobe, Renee stepped out onto the porch, then turned and faced them across the expanse of the foyer. Wind fluttered his hair. Snow had fallen last night. Standing there in the doorway, he was silhouetted against the vivid white backdrop. He curled a finger.
"Come."
Manny and Nando prompted Evan, and he walked across the frigid marble floor. Already he could feel the bite of the outside air. The minute he stepped out, the air assailed him. His boxers provided scant cover. Manny and Nando put him on the opposite side of the porch, safely away from Renee, who stood waiting in his cozy robe and moon boots. Evan tucked the bag of chips into the waistband of his boxers so he could blow into his hands. His cheeks and lips felt raw. He wasn't sure how long he would be able to stand out here. Before he saw anything, he heard the faint drone of an engine reverberating around the walls of the valley. Then a plume of exhaust came visible, thin as a straw, way up the gravel road at the horizon. Soon he made out the dot of a black vehicle. It resolved as one of the Mercedes Geländewagens. The autumn chill burrowed beneath his flesh, firing the nerves inside his scrapes and bruises. Muscle throbbed over aching bones. He thought he might freeze solid before the vehicle, and whatever it was carrying arrived. He bounced on his bare feet, doing his best to keep warm. He could no longer feel his face. On the far side of the porch, Renee whistled the chipper tune. It took an eternity, but at last the G-Wagon pulled into the circular driveway, the tires clicking over the cobblestones. It stopped. The tinted windows threw back Evan's reflection. His skin was tinged blue. The driver's door opened first, and Dex unloaded himself from behind the steering wheel. Then the other three doors and tailgate opened in concert. New narco guards emerged from the G-Wagon, one after another. A clown car stunt carried off with military precision. 10 of them. They formed a neat line in front of the vehicle, awaiting orders from Renee.
"Good," Evan said. "You brought me more people to kill."
But Renee just turned to him, his moon boots scraping on the porch, and smiled.
"No limits," he said.
29. Your bad self.
According to the intel Candy and Jaggers had gathered over the past day and a half, Setyayevo was planning to leave his office between 6 and 6:15 this evening. They shivered through another faux photo shoot down on the boardwalk, Candy looking fetching as ever in her leather pants and bustier getup, Jaggers zooming in over her head at the converted cannery. Soon enough, only Refat Setyayeva remained at the office once again, toiling away. Jaggers checked his watch. It's time. They hustled back to their rental, a Škoda Fabia Kombi, which, with low standards and some squinting, could be considered a car. As Jaggers pulled out of the parking space he'd shoehorned into, Candy bought a berry popsicle from a vendor. They zipped up the hill in the hatchback Super Mini. She hopped out behind the building in the alley that ran between Telephone Star and the parking structure. Jaggers backed up, killed the headlights. Someone had spray-painted the three monkeys on the wall. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. The paint had dripped before it dried, lending the simian faces a demonic cast. Dusk eased down the dial on the day. A few lights blinked on in buildings farther up the hill. Candy propped herself against the wall by the rear door of the old cannery. She peeled back the wrapping on her super fun Crazy Berries ice stick. She could make a spectacle of herself with a popsicle. Setting one foot flat against the wall behind her, she arched her back away from the wall and twirled the ruby-red tip between her lips. She knew precisely what she looked like. It was good to be her. 5:53. No cars. No pedestrians. That whisper returned. Can you still pull this off, Candy? After X left his stamp on you. Are you sure you're the same? Or are you damaged goods? Yes, she was sure. No, she wasn't damaged goods. She was a traffic stopper, a Hall & Oates man-eater, the kind of calendar girl that made you want to freeze the month. She used to be all those things with her clothes on or off. So what if, thanks to Orphan X, her naked superpowers had dimmed? She was still irresistible. 5:57. No vehicles, no foot traffic. The wind shifted, producing a whiff of fish from the walls of the old cannery. The berry ice inexplicably tasted like peach. Somewhere in the distance, someone was blaring a Salt-N-Pepa Led Zeppelin mashup. These post-Soviet states were so gloriously ass-backward. She licked her berry peach ice and waited. Refat Setyayeva, come on with your bad self and your fucked-up name. The door creaked open. At first he didn't see her. His scruffy face stayed bent down as he fumbled a file into a soft briefcase. He got two steps into the alley when she cleared her throat. A soft, feminine melody. He glanced over. That stopped him. He wasn't bear-like, as so many former throwers were. His massive body was still shaped the right way. Mass up top, tapered through the waist. She wondered if he'd given up the steroids entirely, or if they made him look too damn good to quit. He was staring at her, no doubt wondering some things of his own. She was a mirage. He seemed afraid to blink lest she disappear. She parted her mouth, let the ice pop inch further past her orange lips, let her tongue squirm into sight on the side. He didn't notice the Škoda Fabia Kombi rev to life behind him. How could he? His gaze stayed locked on her even as the car bore down, headlights dimmed. She tilted toward him and plucked the soft briefcase from his hand. At the last moment, Setyayeva seemed to come back into his body. He whirled around as the car smashed into him, the brakes already chirping. He flew, landed. A bark of air left his lungs on impact. He stared at her with uncomprehending eyes. She licked up the popsicle's shaft.
Might as well give him a little morphine on his way out.
Jaggers rolled forward, crushing the big man. The car bounced up and down and up and down, and then was in front of him, perfectly positioned to load the body. Jaggers popped the trunk and climbed out. Candy dropped the ice pop and walked over, the briefcase swinging at her side. She smirked at that whisper that had been haunting her of late. Damaged goods, her ass. The Škoda Fabia Kombi had few advantages, but two of them happened to be generous hatch space and a loading sill a mere 611 millimeters off the ground. The roomy hatch was lined with plastic tarp, taped expertly around the sides. Candy took the ankles, Jaggers the armpits. They huffed and they puffed and they swung the man in. The car had no sooner creaked down on its chassis than they heard a clacking of high heels behind them. They turned to see one of the boardwalk girls teetering up the alley toward them, her baby giraffe legs constrained by a micro-mini banding her thighs together. She had a sweet, almond-shaped face, framed with straight, raven-black hair. She might have been 18 or a precocious 15. You never knew with these East Slavic types. She looked very concerned in a wholesome oh-my-gosh way that seemed at odds with her get-up. She said something in what sounded like Turkish, probably Crimean Tatar. Noting their expressions, she switched to Russian.
"Are you all right? Was there an accident?"
"Yes," Candy replied in Russian. "But we're okay." She reached over quickly to shut the hatch, but Jaggers stopped her. Candy looked at him. His button eyes peered back at her, showing no depth. "No," Candy said to him under her breath. Jaggers said nothing, but kept his hand on the underside of the hatch lid, holding it open. The girl drew nearer.
"You're sure you're not hurt? Do you need me to call someone?"
"No, no. We're fine," Candy said. "Thank you, though, sweetheart." The girl stopped. They were alone in the alley, just the three of them cast in the slanting glow thrown from a window above. At some point in the past few minutes, night had come on in full. "We could use a hand with the trunk," Jaggers said. "I think it got warped in the crash. We can't get it closed." The girl looked confused, but she gave a one-shoulder shrug.
"Okay."
As she started toward them, Candy tried again to yank the rear door closed, but Jaggers held it firm. And then it was too late. The girl looked down, saw the tangled body held by the plastic lining, and opened her mouth. Jaggers sealed in her scream with a jaundiced hand, his fist jabbing twice at her neck. He dumped her into the cargo space on top of Setyeva's body and slammed the hatch lid. Only now did Candy see the slim silver pen clenched in Jaggers' bloody hand. The girl rattled against the closed hatch, wet thrashing, a screech of breath. The words hissed through Candy's teeth, cold with rage. "She's still alive." "Not for long." Jaggers squatted, dropped the pen down a sewer drain, and rose, wiping his hand on the thigh of his slacks. The rattling grew fainter, and then stopped. Candy punched him, a quick jab that snapped his head back on his stick neck. The pain seemed to have no effect. He dodged her cross, countering with a gut shot that doubled her over. Then he laid her low with a leg sweep. As she curled on the ground, sucking for air, he pressed himself on top of her, his slender fingers cinched not too tightly around her neck. "She saw us." Though he kept his voice low, he wore a grimace, and through his clenched teeth wafted the stink of his breath, stomach acid and rot. She brought a knee up between his legs hard enough to jolt him a foot forward, but he didn't so much as grunt. He only rolled off her, climbed into the driver's seat, and waited. Candy rose and stood for a time in the dark alley, giving her breath time to even out. Then she walked around and got in. They drove several blocks in silence. Jaggers pulled over by the body shop they had scouted the night before. Leaving the car running, he picked the padlock and slid the gate open.
He drove through and into the garage. Another benefit of Škoda Fabias. Crimea was lousy with them, like cockroaches, and every shop worth its salt was stocked with spare parts. As Jaggers pulled off the crumpled bumper, Candy took from Setyaeva's briefcase his laptop, as well as a hardware token crypto card that generated a new randomized login code every 60 seconds. Sitting on a workbench with the laptop resting across her knees, she waited for the token numbers to flip, then punched in the code. She and Jaggers slugged away quietly and in concert, Candy clicking on the keyboard while he mounted a new bumper and grill and hammered out creases in the hood. He worked with the quick, efficient movements of a rodent. They were making good headway, and the night was young, but they still had to deal with the bodies in the trunk. She accessed the databases, finally locating what looked like the right one. Then she ran a search for 1-855-2-NOWHERE and waited for the data to load. The information came up. "God damn it," she said. "God damn it!" Jaggers looked up from his crouch at the bumper, where he was wielding a spray paint gun. In the dim light, his dark eyes were holes in his face. A surgeon-like paint mask covered his nose and mouth, so his voice seemed to issue from the air itself. "What?" it asked. "Orphan X never parked the phone number here. It was a misdirect. He paid them a fee to open a dummy account." "Orphan Y can follow the money." Candy sneered. She'd been at this longer than Jaggers. "Orphan X set up that account for us to find, you idiot. Which means there will be no following the money. Not by Van Sciver, his Uber software, or anyone or anything else." Jaggers returned to his work, misting a fine layer of silver across the crease in the hood. The news seemed to carry no weight for him. She wondered if he cared about anything. "You killed that girl for nothing," she said. He didn't shift focus from his work. "We killed Refat Setyaeva for nothing." "Yeah, but that was the job." A line of silver paint settled across the hood, effacing the final flaw. "How interesting that you see a distinction." He set down the spray gun and appraised the car, which looked as good as new. Then he retrieved his carry-on bag from the back seat and began to strip. He kicked off his shoes and tugged down his pants. He wore no underwear. What she saw startled her. Rather, what she didn't see. She'd heard of it before, of course, but it seemed like one of those bizarre conditions consigned to medical case studies and dusty journals. Not something that belonged out here in the real world. He piled his bloody clothes on the concrete floor, spilled some oil on them, and lit them on fire. Then he looked up, naked, unashamed, and expressionless. "I suggest you do the same." Her leather pants were clean, but her bustier sported a few smears from moving Setyaeva. As Jaggers dressed in fresh clothes, she stripped off her shirt and threw it onto the small pyre. She grabbed her encrypted sat phone and walked outside, already dialing. Standing beneath the firmament, she waited as it rang and rang. A click announced Van Sciver's presence on the line.
"How was your
meal?"
"No nutritional content," she said.
There was a slight delay as their conversation ping-ponged between various virtual telephone switch destinations.
"Are there any in greed,
Jens, we might
use to prepare a future meal?"
"No." She waited until it became clear that this was not a delay, but a silence. She'd visited Orphan Y at his undisclosed location only once, choppering in with a hood over her head. She pictured him there in his great room, lost in the flickering lights of the monitors, his very flesh seeming to crawl with the numbers pouring across the screens. It was as if he'd achieved singularity, given up his human form to become one with the data. "Why?" she said. "You there?" I will identify
his
next reservation, and I will
send you two
to
dine with
him.